Welcome to another episode of the Grass Clippings Podcast, a podcast dedicated to celebrating the world of turf grass and the people who make it thrive. In this episode, Kelly Lynch, PGA Regional Manager at Pearseed and one of the founders of the Women in Turf Grass organization, interviews your host, Crystal Rose Fricker, the president of Pearseed and Pearseed Testing, to get an insider's look into the seed market today.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm really excited, Crystal, today because we haven't had a time to reflect and catch up on some of the things that are happening, not only in our industry domestically, but also our industry globally. So I was hoping that you might share some insights today on what you see happening. Maybe we start from the domestic side and what you think that's happening, and then also tie it into what's happening globally.
Well, the turf grass industry is in flux right now. It's never in my lifetime have I seen it this off, meaning we have more grass seed than is needed. The markets are not moving as freely as they usually do. I think people are risk adverse and still value grass and seed. You don't have anything if you don't plant seed, right? We don't need fertilizer. We don't need chemicals or pesticides, herbicides, et cetera, if we don't have some grass to maintain and take care of. And in our industry, turf grass is so large, we don't, I think, even realize how big it is. Grass is used everywhere around the world, both forages and turf. But if you were to go to the agronomy meetings, the division, this is called the C5 division in crop science, is the largest division because there are that many folks who have a career in studying grass, maintaining grass, breeding grass, developing technologies to better utilize grass and be more efficient, drought tolerance, all the various aspects. So there's a lot of people that are in this industry, but they don't all realize, I think, where the seed comes from and the process we go through to develop varieties and bring seed to the market and the difficulties that we're having today. And that can start with the grower, can also affect breeders' rights, which we can talk about today, and the markets and the overproduction situation that we're in. There's a lot of reasons for why we're where we are today, but I just truly feel that our industry is changing. You know, we have new technologies that are coming on that everyone needs to learn and adapt to and utilize. And in agriculture, we have things that work, but we're always trying to be more proactive and more efficient. Farmers are very good scientists and very good stewards of the land. But at the end, everybody has to make money. And the seed is so important. Our customers really value that, right? They want the best seed they can get. How do we get there?
And I love that you share that because we're a research-based company. And every time I get to speak to any outside audiences, I say we are a research-based company that happens to market and sell our own products, which is a little bit of an anomaly and getting more so in the industry. And, I recruited myself to work for you and Pearseed so that because the genetics were top on my list, I could see that there was a distinct difference and certainly years and decades of research and all the things that have gone into the genetic side. But what I'm also seeing is a fight against VNS, varieties not stated aside. And when we see this market that has twofolds happening, one, yes, there is an overage of seed, but mind you, seed is as a yearly crop, right? So if we had any kind of unforeseen weather event and or drought event and or like several years ago, the fires and the storms and the ice, how are you kind of navigating the genetic side and the improved varieties versus the VNS side and varieties not stated when there is an overage and abundance of seed in the market?
Well, you know, it takes a good 10 years to develop a variety. So we're investing in that. We're trying to develop varieties for the future because it takes 10 years to develop a variety. And so we're putting a lot of inputs. We're trying to decide what to breed for. And that could be drought tolerance, disease resistance, you know, things that are good for the environment. But we also have to think about the grower, because the grower has to make a living and all their costs continue to increase. So one way to do that is to increase seed yield, which we have done a good job of that on some of our varieties. And a lot of growers really want to grow for us, especially today when they're not getting, agriculture has a lot of bumps right now. Wheat is low. There's just not a lot of choices for growers to produce. And in Oregon, we have hazelnuts, berries, but those prices haven't been great. And so even hay, you know, the cattle industry is doing better, but there's just so many things that make it difficult for a grower to survive. And now that's turned into dealers. Dealers are struggling as well. The wholesale seed suppliers, the situation there is we have to put out contracts with growers, and they're not just a one-year contract. You mentioned that we get the crop in 12 months. It's usually 18 to 12 months before you get your crop. But then we have to harvest that seed, and a contract with the grower is anywhere from 3 to 5 years. And so that is something that we have to navigate. We have to predict. We need a crystal ball to know how much seed we need 5 years from now. And so, you know, we're not dealing with widgets. We're dealing with live plants that the grower has to try and make success with it, even though there's an ice storm or there's insect, or now we have mice that are eating up the field. Slugs and mice are a serious problem for growers today. And there's less tools to take care of those kind of environmental impacts that they have to deal with. So breeding varieties is one way, varieties that growers like to grow. But on the other hand, you have to have a variety that the market wants. So that's where we as seed dealers try to connect the dots. We get a variety that we think our customers will want. We get growers to grow that seed, and then we sell it. And the price to the market is affected by the quality of the seed, the genetics of the seed, the volume of the seed, and supply and demand. So right now, we have more supply than we do demand. But as I was saying earlier, I think our customers are more risk adverse and they're waiting to purchase their seed. And this is causing a problem as the seed is building up in the growers' warehouses and wholesale warehouses. And normally they would plan ahead and ship loads of seed to be ready for the spring market and ready for the fall market. And it's like they expect us to be Amazon, where we can produce a seed in a week, or a bag of seed, or, you know, and maybe it's just a pallet of seed. It's not even a whole truckload. And or the truckload is a mixture of all different kinds of seeds. And that is a lot of effort that the seed dealers are doing. And it's hard right now because growers are feeling like, well, why don't I just sell the seed myself? And so we need to communicate the value of everything a seed dealer does, because there are so many things that we have to do to service the end user, whether that be a golf course, a sports field, a homeowner, or another distributor in a region that is handling our seeds.
And when you speak of that, we also, in terms of when we're looking at a grower situation versus a dealer situation, we are set up to blend and package and bag and tag and ship and do all of those things. So even if it's a short-term scenario, it's really the dealer in the long run that has the sustainable portion of that, those services that are tied to not only what we do for the industry in terms of art for our distributors, but the consistency of it year over year. We're set up to do that. And I think that you make a great point that it's our intention to be efficient in what we do and how we do it, to have all the highest end of seed and the packaging that comes with it and the tagging and all of those things. And then the re-tagging, that's something that we don't talk about. If seed has gone out and it hasn't sold over a season, and it has to be retagged. Those are all services that are tied directly to what a dealer does, such as ourselves as Pure Seed. And so I think that is a distinct difference between what can happen versus with going with a dealer versus going grower direct, and because it's not sustainable year over year. That also brought me to another question for you, because you're seeing, I think that would be one of the industry trends that we're touching on, because there is an overage of seed. But what happens when it's the opposite? And there is not enough seed. And now you come back to dealers relying upon them to not have been, you know, to not cut out the middleman, if you will. Not that we're the middleman. I don't think that's a really good use of that term, because we provide so many services that are tied to what happens from the genetics and the 10 years cycle that it takes to produce grass seed, but then also the service component of it to take care of our distributors year over year. And so you're starting to see some industry shifts there and growers trying to go direct. But do you really feel like that's a sustainable portion, or is that just temporary? And when things get tight and coatings needed and other things aren't available, I think that's where partnerships really come into play.
Yeah, I feel like this industry is relationship-based. And I was just, you know, think about yourself. So you are a saleswoman for Pure Seed, and just think about all the points of contact for, let's maybe take one load of seed that you sell, starting with what do you need to do? The travel, the phone calls, the emails. I mean, even preparing one load, the blending, the coating, the mixing, the packaging, getting the right bag, marketing, developing a bag, the phytosanitary tests. And that's just domestic. If you go international, it adds a whole nother layer of things that the seed dealer has to do. But we have to prepare in advance even to just have that seed. So we have to bring the seed in from the grower at the right time and get all the components from all the different growers, test all those components, put those together in an efficient manner to get the seed out to our customer. And I feel like Pure Seed has done such a great job in the last few years through the ice storms, through the fires, through COVID, through the shortage, to be able to serve our customers and give them seed when they need it. But maybe that's part of it. We've spoiled them a bit. And so talk to me a little bit about your perspective on what it takes to move seed today.
I think that's the point, Mike. The things that we do on a daily basis, whether it's working with our distributors and their customers, whether it's training sales teams, speaking at events, traveling, whether it's a trade show that's directly related to a distributor, or it's an industry show like the golf industry show and the sports field managers show. I think that our presence there is critical. I think that our messaging, the things that we do on a daily basis to make it easier. And that's, I always say, my job is to make their job easier, right? Whether it's picking the varieties that are going to perform in their area, blending the varieties so that their, whatever their attributes are and their traits are highlighted in those end users' bags. And I just spoke at an event last week and I said, my job is to make your job easy so that you don't even have to worry about what's in the bag. But I'm here today to tell you it's 10 years of research and dedication that it takes to develop just the genetics that are in your bag, but then it's all the steps that come after it. It's managing the fields, it's managing the cleaning schedules, it's managing what varieties are in the bag, what kind of materials and marketing materials are assigned to those products, and then what do we do in terms of support. And I think that you touch on a very critical piece, is that that's the relationship part. That's the things that we hold dear. And to just park all of that for a price, and really a temporary price if it's coming from a direct scenario, because that's not always a sustainable year-over-year partnership. That just happens to come up when there's too much seed in the market, especially if the international markets haven't taken as much seed as anticipated, and a lot more seed is in the domestic market.
Yeah, I'd say it's a good 3 to 5, even 10 years to get a variety accepted in the marketplace, get it, you know, from deciding to go forward with a variety and produce the breeder seed, the foundation seed, the certified seed, and then start marketing it and talking about it and delivering it, and then them planting it. It takes a year or two for them to say, wow, that is a really good variety. And then they talk about it and the success starts to build and then develops a want for that seed and that specific genetics. But then you have to grow it and get the right quality. And we don't always get 100% 00 seed. So we have to plant a lot more just to get enough 00 for our customers. And the other seeds, we have to figure out what to do with them. We can't just tell the grower, yep, we're not paying you at all. They still grew it. And it has less value, but it has value. And I think that leads to, it also has a name.
Mm-hmm.
Everything planted by a grower has a name. But somehow we talked ourselves into believing that we don't always want to use the name. And if the quality is not meeting certified standards or our contracted standards, then we release that back on the grower and we say, don't use the name anymore. It's VNS and you need to sell it. And then they try to work with brokers or if they have any contacts, but it's much, much harder for a grower to move seed, especially in a poor market. And so all the prices just tumble down. But I would say that every grower plants a variety for a reason. He has to have a contract or he knows it's a good yielder. And every buyer is buying something because of what it is. And there's all these qualifications that you must step through to get the buyer to actually buy. But the most important thing is, what is it? Because we need truth in labeling in this industry. Our whole industry is pretty much based on trust. And when we don't have the trust, and VNS to me takes away all trust because you really don't know what it's supposed to be. And that is when some shenanigans can happen. And you think you're getting this variety that's VNS that you're told, yeah, it's really this. Well, it's actually not that. It could be something else. And the quality is never what you suspect. And so, I mean, I've been out to a sod farm, believe it or not, a sod farm that utilized some VNS in a blend with our seed. It was a huge problem. You could see exactly what happened in the plants in that sod.
So what are some of the things happening now to shift away from the VNS portal, if you will? Because as you say, there's a lot of things that have transpired over the years. And one of the things that I believe they've shifted a little bit is K31. There's actually a test that can actually decipher if it's actually a K31 or not. So are there other things in play like that scenario where VNS will not be accepted and that the variety will need to be stated, that all the things that are attached to that varietal name are intact? Is there anything in play like that?
Yeah, there's a couple different things. Currently, there's 17 states that don't allow VNS. Did you know that?
No, I did not.
They're smart. They have been burned by it, or they want truth in labeling for their state. And so we're working with breeders for starters, because when VNS is released to the grower and sold, a lot of times the breeder does not get their royalty for that seed because the name is gone and all kinds of things can happen with that seed. So I'm starting with breeders and working together to protect breeders' rights and looking at the Federal Seed Act. And there's a lot of people involved, and that's, this situation affects all levels, from the breeder to the grower to the wholesale seed supplier to the distributor to the end user when they buy VNS or not. So we're trying to work on looking at that. What can we do to change where we're at today? And that requires changing the Federal Seed Act. It requires looking at each state that still allows VNS and genetic testing. Our technology is so advanced today that we can do genetic testing. You mentioned Kentucky 31. You can tell if it's real Kentucky 31 with a genetic test or fraud, fake Kentucky 31. And the temptation to make fake seed, if you call it, is to put something in the bag that isn't what it's labeled as because it's worth more. And what you have isn't worth as much because it's not that genetic variety. So we need to start sampling our lots, doing genetic testing. And it's kind of like a scatter diagram where you see the dots that cluster together that are one variety. And if it's a different variety, the scattergram will be over in the left quadrant of your table. And you'll be seeing, oh, there's two sets of dots here. That means there's more than one variety there, or it's not what it's supposed to be. So I think we need to, as breeders, identify all our varieties and use that with our plant variety protection and patenting, and maybe get that word out to growers and buyers that we can identify what's in the bag. We do that now with our Bermuda varieties, and that has really been a successful program where we track every field we plant. We can do a genetic test and identify that it is the variety it is. And I even have growers willing to send in samples to make sure their field is pure and clean kind of on top of certification, if you will, another level of guaranteeing that what's in the bag is what it's supposed to be. And I think with our current technology, our agriculture and the turfgrass industry, we need to catch up, if you will, to the rest of the world and quit selling commodities and sell varieties.
I think that's a soundbite right there by itself, because it is changing and it's rapidly changing. And I think one of the things that you're heavily involved in is you're the VP for the Northwest for the American Seed Trade Association. And do you also feel like there is a need, not only domestically, but globally, to address some of these things? Like you said, the Federal Seed Act and those pieces that go beyond a generalized area, but go all the way to Washington, D.C.
Yes, mainly because the U.S. is the only one that allows VNS. Other global markets do not.
I didn't know.
And we only allow it on certain species. Most of our crops do not have the VNS law. So it's grass seed and a few other species.
Okay, so then what would you see happening in the future in terms of a regulation and or an update to the Seed Act that could help in this scenario? Or is it more on a localized basis with breeders and growers and distributors?
It's all levels. If we can, I mean, that's what we're working with ASTA on. So we have a white paper that we're going to circulate, and what we're looking for is support. So anybody in the industry that has been burned by VNS or feels like we need to just label what's in the bag as what's in the bag, we're looking for that kind of support to go to Washington, D.C. and say, hey, it's time. So example, I spoke at the Pacific Seed Association meetings. I was supposed to give the market report, and it turned into an open discussion, essentially, about where are we going as a seed industry and why don't we label what's in the bag. And a gentleman stood up and said, you know, we have this problem in triticale right now. There's lawsuits going because of mislabeling in that industry because of VNS. So if we just don't have VNS and we label what's in the bag, that's an easy step. The more difficult situation is in the cleaner, where they mix a lot of runoff that doesn't make the quality together. And that, I think, is the original idea behind VNS, that it really wasn't just a variety or even a blend of a few varieties. It was all the runoff. So we need to work with cleaners. And that's the difference between U.S. production, is our growers might have their own cleaner, or they might hire their seed to be cleaned through a cleaner, and the cleaner's in control of all that. Whereas in Europe, each company cleans their own seed and they have total control of it. So we're a little bit freer in the U.S., if you will, and need to do a better job, I think, of testing and accountability in where the seed comes from and what we do with it once we get it in the bag and how we label it.
And I think one point that you touched on earlier was that it's all relationship. It's all tied into the relationships and getting back, with no pun intended, to the grassroots of the industry. You know, there were a lot of things that were done on handshake deals. There were a lot of things that were done on good faith. And it would be good to see some of that come back to that, to see that the partnerships and the relationships and the handshakes and that actually mean have the value tied to it, so that we can create essentially a new version of those good qualities of the past that maybe we've some parts of the industry have gotten away from. It might behoove the industry as a whole to get back to some of the more wholesome valued items and standards that really are what made the industry so powerful, both from a relational standpoint and finding ways to work together to solve problems instead of finding shortcut solutions that impact certain parts of the industry.
Yeah, because I mean, we are all in this together. We are, grass is huge, but our industry is a tight-knit industry. Everyone knows what's going on with their competitors, with their customers, and the growers all talk. And with the communication that we have today, as soon as something happens, everybody kind of knows it. So we try to be fully transparent with what we do and our pricing, etc. But we need to be partners, because it doesn't work for just one part of the flow of the seed to make money. Is literally, I don't even know how many levels of people trying to make money off the seed as it goes from the breeder to the grower, to the wholesale supplier, to a distributor, to a turf manager, to the end user. There's all these levels that everyone makes money on grass seed, but we barely make money. And some of the diversifying that companies are doing to survive is to do something besides just seed. And I think that's wrong. We are experts in seed. That's all we do. And it's our livelihood. It's been in our family for three generations, and our employees all have been in this business. I mean, we're celebrating 50 years of pure seed testing. So we've been doing this a long time. And that's how agriculture is. It's usually families and generations that fall in love with working with seed and plants and people and kind of connecting that, because not everyone knows how to raise a plant or grow something. But if we work together, we can learn how to do it and get the benefits of grass, because grass is so good. There's so many things that grass brings to the table. And we think, well, it's not a food crop. Well, it's part of a food crop when the forages feed our animals, but it's what holds the soil together. It's what creates oxygen. It's what makes a beautiful environment that people want to be in to live. And all our sports events. I mean, there's just thing after thing, event after event, seed after seed that makes a difference with grass seed. We need to protect that. And I think the way we protect that is by using new technologies, communicating, educating, and standing up for being accountable, standing up for the right seeds in the right time.
Well said. And I think that's where your wisdom comes in. There's, like you said, multiple generations that take this not only as a profession, but as a passion, as a stewardship, not only of the land and the resources, but taking care of those things. And this might be a great time to touch on the Turfgrass Water Conservation Alliance and talking about those traditions and finding new generations of solutions that use up to 40% less water. And what that means. And I think you also touched on a really important part is the creation of oxygen, but also the mass amounts of carbon sequestration that's happening because those bodies of stands of grass can take a lot. I think you talk a lot in those last few comments on the sustainability part. Maybe you could speak to us a little bit about that.
Yeah. Grass is excellent for the soil, creates carbon, and they've done studies that it's a carbon sink for 100 years, one planting of grass. So it utilizes way less than it produces, essentially. And the value of grass is hit so many levels that it's very difficult to quantify that, because you just take that piece. And when you plant grass, it's a perennial plant. And so it can be there for a long time if it's good genetics. But usually the environment is pretty tough. And at some point, we need to redo our grass areas. But when you plant a good seed in the beginning, it can easily last. My in-laws' grass is still there that we planted in the 1980s. Looks great. Tall fescue on terrible soil and doing wonderful. So it's once you plant it, it can be there for a long time. So it's very sustainable. And so it's just a good thing that we as an industry need to do a better job, I think, of tooting our own horn and saying, this is what this does. And the value that it has around the world is immeasurable. I mean, it's on the World Cup. It's on the Ryder Cup. It's on these events that are so important to people, but they have no clue, I think, a lot of times about what goes into that grass from the beginning of the seed to the whole crew that's taking care of the field and the athletes. And just the athletes' appreciation of natural turf is huge. We get so many comments and feedback, and just for the athlete's health, of the value of grass. And so we need to do more espousing, if you will, on that. And I think that will be some future grass clippings commentary and podcasts that we do, I think, is talking. I would like to talk to some athletes or at least the turf managers. We did a local one of our Canby field here. And with TWACA, the Turfgrass Water Conservation Alliance, we're looking to save water at the same time. So having grasses that work for the end user, but also save water, they're finding now in Utah, It's, I think, over 70 million gallons of water has been saved in just a few years of using grasses that are third-party validated to use 60% less water is what they're actually finding. But there's stringent trials and research that breeders and seed dealers go through to find these varieties to make a difference. And we're finally getting them out there in the world and getting results. And people are very happy, very pleased. And we're working with homeowners. So that's the hardest, you know, most homeowners have no idea. So, you know, with the turf trade-up program in Utah, it's now spreading community by community, city by city, and now going to other states because the benefits of grass are worth it when we also see that we can maintain them with less water.
I have to backtrack a little bit because I also have had the privilege to work at a lot of the venues that you speak of, these championship venues, whether it's been the Softball Little League World Series or the U.S. Women's Opens, the U.S. Men's Open. But fun story from the Arnold Palmer at Bay Hill, showcasing all of your perennial ryegrass to be there working the tournament, but then to also be there watching on game day when the tournament is playing. Mm-hmm. And there are people actually rolling around in your grass. I think I actually sent you a video of a group of grown adults, men and women. Now, they probably had a little bit to drink, but they had hopped under the ropes and were doing grass angels in your perennial ryegrass rough at Arnold Palmer's Invitational at Bay Hill. So also, I think those are the things that we really want to showcase and celebrate, because there are so many venues that showcase your genetics that a lot of people don't even realize what's gone into that. But you see the outcome in them enjoying what's happening. So I applaud you for that. And I've had the privilege to be there. And I know you were there with me a couple of years ago to see it in for your own eyes and listen to the stories. But it's pretty powerful.
It's really, really powerful. And what's really fun is, as we were watching, just talking to, you know, the crowd and mentioning the seed and the grass and where it came from. They love that story. They want to hear that. And it's really interesting. And I think we just need to convert more people into being turf geeks, because it's cool. There's so much interesting things about grass. And not everybody's raised on a farm or gets to be out in the outdoors and grow grass. But that's part of, I think, the pull for sports turf managers and people in our industry, that they're not just behind a computer all day long. They get to go outside and interact, and they get to go and visit people and see these sites and see how the product's being used. So it's a wonderful career. And we just need to make sure we have that in the future, because there's so many things in flux in our industry right now. And this is one aspect of it. I think we need to have some more conversations and talk about some of the other areas, because there's so many exciting, cool things happening that we're a part of and that I think we will continue to be a part of. So next time on Grass Clippings, I think we're going to have some more fun topics to visit about.
I look forward to it, Krista. It's always fun to spend some time with you, and happy birthday in advance.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Grass Clippings Podcast. On our next episode, Krista will interview Ava Feith, a former college soccer athlete and current master's student at Virginia Tech. We look forward to hearing about her experience as an athlete playing on natural grass and her current research on field safety for athletes. If you found this episode valuable, don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. Until next time, may your passion for turf grass inspire greatness.